Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Hello, I'm Matt Kelly.
And I'm Matt D'Ancona.
And this is the Two Mats for the week ending Friday the 7th of March. And this, folks, is our very first transatlantic podcast. Because where are you, Matt D'Ancona?
I am in New York City, just off Times Square, and having a fascinating time.
And what did we talk about relevant to that?
Well, we talked about Trump and Biden and Super Tuesday and what Biden has to do if he's to stand a chance of not being another one-term president. And we talked a bit of New York culture at the end. So it was very much a dispatcher in New York, I guess.
Excellent. Okay, well, that gives us a clue for the title. I think we can call it Live from New York City.
Live from New York City. Why not?
Okay. So this is the Two Mats, episode 35, Live from New York City.
Enjoy.
So, Matt, obviously a massively consequential week to be in New York City. What is going on in America, please?
Well, the top line really is that Trump is the story, more even than when we're observing it from the other side of the Atlantic in the UK. And he's on a roll. And we've just had Super Tuesday, 15 states and one territory, American Samoa. And Trump won all of them, apart from Vermont, which Nikki Haley won. He's well on the way to the 1,215 delegates he needs to win the Republican nomination. He already has more than 1,000, but he's already being described officially by the Republican National Committee as the presumptive nominee. So he's the nominee. I wonder if we might kick off with a blast of him being characteristically self-effacing at Mar-a-Lago on Tuesday night. I wonder if Producer Matt can help us with that.
Well, thank you very much. They call it Super Tuesday for a reason. This is a big one. And they tell me, the pundits and otherwise, that there's never been one like this. There's never been anything so conclusive. This was an amazing night, an amazing day. It's been an incredible period of time.
The greatest ever results ever.
Greatest ever. But it is a historic moment. I mean, it's the first time a current and a past president have been facing each other for more than a century. For those that are interested, the last time was Theodore Roosevelt, who was running as a progressive, running against William Howard Taft. He'd been elected in 1908, in 1912. Actually, Woodrow Wilson won that election. But anyway, it's going back a long time. And you have to go back to Grover Cleveland to find a president who was elected, lost, and then won again. So really, we're in unknown territory. I think what I'd say, Matt, is that, you know, looking at Trump first, he's had a really amazing series of breaks in the last week or so. I mean, the first is that the Florida trial, the classified documents case, the date is now up in the air. The Georgia, the big racketeering case, the RICO case that we were very interested in and talked about in the pod earlier last year, has become mired in a sort of non-row over whether the Fulton County District Attorney Fannie T. Willis and her lead prosecutor, Nathan Wade, had an inappropriate relationship and whether money changed hands. There's no legal content to it, but it's doing what Trump wants, which is to delay the case. Then you've got Jack Smith, the special counsel's big January the 6th federal election interference case in Washington. That's been delayed. That was meant to be going on kind of now because the Supreme Court has decided to rule on Trump's ridiculous claim to presidential immunity. They'll probably say he doesn't have it, but it'll push the date of the trial back. Then the Supreme Court dismissed the case that Trump's name can be taken off the ballot as it was going to be in Colorado, Maine, and Illinois under the 14th Amendment. They've said, nope, that can't happen. And then in the polls, there was a poll at the weekend. We wrote a little bit about it in the New European this week, New York Times, Siena College national poll, in which Biden was 5 points behind Trump, which is the largest lead Trump has held in that survey since entering politics. And there's some really striking figures in that poll. 43% of respondents said that Biden's policies have hurt them. Not just they're against them, but they've hurt the respondents. It's extraordinary.
But the most amazing thing I thought out of that poll was this extraordinary, well, for me anyway, 10% of Biden's voters in 2020 are now saying they're going to vote for Trump.
Amazing.
And there's been no flip on the other side for Biden.
And there was an interesting article in the New York Times sort of linked to this, which was drilling into what you might call Trumpnesia, which is that a lot of American voters have sort of forgotten the horrific detail of Trump's presidency. And because the last few years have been tough, you know, economically, post-COVID, all sorts of problems associated with Ukraine, food supply chains, and so on. People have had a hard time. And because memories, attention spans are so short, but also I think an interesting point that I've heard made more than once, which is that when you've got such a polarized society, the agreement on a common set of facts is very small. So actually relatively short-term memories can get very, very fuzzy. And a lot of voters are now looking amazingly back on the Trump years as a kind of halcyon era. That, you know, incredible as it is to say, they're looking back on the Trump presidency with nostalgia. So I think it's a huge problem. It really is.
I mean, that's absolutely right, isn't it? And what I find really interesting is how Biden, you can see the Biden campaign team actively addressing that, because in their literature, in that same piece, that New York Times piece you're referring to, it noted how Biden had put in an election campaign a direct quote saying, remember how you felt after Donald Trump was elected. Remember walking around in disbelief and fear of what was to come. So you can see them trying to say, folks, you know, it's only 3 years ago. Can you not remember what an absolute chaotic onslaught Donald Trump's presidency was?
Absolutely. And I think that this is interesting because it leads on to the question of Nikki Haley, who's persistence in staying in the race has mystified a lot of people, including here. Nikki Haley, former governor of South Carolina and UN ambassador under Trump. She was the last person standing, and it infuriated Trump that she waited until after Super Tuesday to throw the towel in. And the question is why she's done this, because it has certainly, you know, a lot of people have been mystified why she's bothered. She spent a huge amount of money for nothing, it would appear. And I think there's a reason, which is that Trump has the party machinery now totally kissing the ring. The Republican National Committee, you know, his daughter-in-law, Lara, is going to be one of the co-chairs. You've had the Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, already congratulating Trump as the presumptive nominee. Mitch McConnell, the outgoing Senate minority leader, whose wife, Elaine Chao, Trump was racist about, and who back in around January the 6th said it was quite clear that Trump was responsible for January the 6th. McConnell has come out and said he backs Trump for the presidency. I mean, it's a pathetic sight.
Amazing.
Craven administration. But the important thing that what Haley has done, which is very clever is that she's shown, yes, the Republican machine is totally owned by Trump, but not Republican voters, not Republican voters, not all of them. Quite a few of them are made anxious by the idea of Trump becoming president again. So, you know, you've had in Iowa 49% voting against him, 45% in New Hampshire, 40% in South Carolina. You know, these are significant numbers. These are people who went out, Republican, registered Republicans, and some, because of the weirdness of America's primary system, some independents and even some Democrats. But nonetheless, it's not nothing. And Haley's announcement that she was suspending her campaign was very interesting. She didn't endorse him. She said, it's now up to Donald Trump to earn the votes of those in our party and beyond it, who did not support him.
It's very interesting, isn't it? Because one of the things that has been noted in several articles I've read is how Trump really hasn't spent much money advertising. He hasn't really got anything of a platform you could describe. There's no sort of manifesto for change. In fact, the only kind of mantra he's coming out is that victory will be our revenge.
Yes, exactly.
You know, that's only going to appeal to a very core Trump fan. And that, but it's a much wider field than that, isn't it, when it comes down to
it? I don't think she'll... You'd think from some of the coverage that Nikki Haley was Shirley Williams, but she really isn't. You know, she was a Tea Party candidate. She's dry as dust economically, you know, pro-choice, pro-life, and all those sort of right-wing Republican things. She's just not MAGA nationalist populist. So I don't think she'll ever support Biden, although I have to say New York is awash with rumors that there are backdoor negotiations going on about her getting a job in the Biden administration if he wins, which is interesting. But I think the more important point is that she's used this period where, to Trump's fury, she stayed in the race to show American voters outside the Republican Party, not all Republicans are behind this guy. You know, yes, a majority, but not all. So don't think that you're kind of, it's a fait accompli, the juggernaut is going to roll over you, you have no choice, it's all a done deal. Trump will be back in the White House next January. And I think that's quite an important thing. It may not be enough, but it's something. The other thing to note about Trump, and as I wrote in the European this week, is the one part of America that is going after him without any, you know, abashment or delay is New York, which made him. There's the hush money case coming up on March the 25th, which is very soon. And much more amusingly, they are trying to take away all his money because he has had some terribly big damages awards against him in the various civil suits, more than $500 million in total. And the district attorney, Alvin Bragg, is behind the case, the Stormy Daniels case, the hush money case, which is coming up on March 25th. But Letitia James, who's the attorney general of New York, could easily on the same day, coincidentally, if Trump doesn't come up with the $500 million plus, start seizing his assets like Trump Tower. So there's whether that'll happen or not, who knows? But there's a wonderful symmetry in the fact that New York that made Trump is now the one part of America that's reliably pursuing his utter destruction.
And Matt, you've been in New York for, well, the best part of a week now. You know, that's a great summary of where we're at in terms of news, but what's the mood like in New York? What are people saying on the street?
Well, I there are several things worth pointing out. I mean, the first is that sort of as you know, New York is a heavily Democrat town, 80% Democrat. I've never known a more dispirited mood because I think that, you know, New Yorkers pride themselves on being one of the twin engines of American global power. You know, one is New York, one is Los Angeles. And I think they thought in 2020 that Trump was done. And the fact that he's not has really thrown them. And there's a lot of fatalism about, you know, a lot of what do we have to do? You know, Biden has done a good job. I don't understand. Hunkering down. The other thing, which is a bit more specific, but I think plays into that, is that the mayor, Eric Adams, has recently indicated, Democrat has recently indicated that New York may no longer be a sanctuary city. All that means really is that it, as a city, it doesn't really cooperate with federal immigration forces. And the upshot of that is that immigrants come here and feel welcome. And for the first time, really, in decades, I mean, this goes back to Mayor Koch in 1989, this sanctuary city idea. This is under threat, and Mayor Adams has said that, you know, he's not happy with the idea of criminals being allowed to walk the streets of New York without any, with essential immunity from federal forces. And symbolically, that's a huge moment, as is the New York governor, Kathy Hochul, has just ordered, believe it or not, the National Guard and state police into New York City's subway system. And so with migration and the National Guard going in to stop crime, you can see that even a city as liberal as New York is beginning to skew towards the kind of issues that favour Trump.
I was just going to ask you to expand on that a bit, because I'd never heard of this sanctuary city concept before. Is that an actual legal entity then?
Well, it's a very good question. I mean, sanctuary cities' status thereof vary hugely around America. Precisely how legal the status is has been tried and tested in the courts many, many times. But in terms of a sort of statement of political and social identity, it's very important, because what it is, it enables a city that doesn't like, you know, characteristically a Republican anti-immigrant measure to say we're not going to cooperate with federal immigration officials who come snooping. And it's interesting that one of the first things and one of the most brutal things Trump proposes to do, you'll have heard that he wants to deport 12 million immigrants. I think it's been less appreciated in the UK that when he says that, what he means is not just people around the border. He means the National Guard going into settled communities around America and pulling individual family members out of houses. I mean, this is a big, big, big moment in American history if it happens. You know, you really are not talking about a kind of frontier conflict, a border conflict. You're talking about possibly even military personnel going into parts of America where there may be second, third, fourth, fifth, even many more generation immigrants who will have their families broken up because one of them is undocumented.
It sounds a bit like some sort of slightly more cultivated style of ethnic cleansing.
It is exactly that, in the sense, or rather, it's a, you know, pseudo bureaucratic version of ethnic cleansing. But can you imagine? I mean, when you think back to January the 6th, the BLM protests, Charlottesville. I mean, the scope for disorder, pain, anguish proceed from such a policy is amazing. So, I mean, to go back to your original question about the mood in New York is pretty bleak, I think. You know, there's not a great deal of optimism, partly because, you know, a year ago, a lot of the same people were saying, oh, by now the economy's recovery will have kicked in, voters will be giving Biden credit. Well, they're not. And there's, you know, only 8 months to go to the election. So when is this great moment going to happen?
It is obviously a machine of enormous complexity, any election, especially in a country as vast and diverse as the States. One of the complex elements that I hadn't considered until I read about it yesterday was this idea. There's 4.2 million 18-year-olds going to vote in this election for the first time. They can't remember what Trump was like. They were, you know, 14. They didn't care. What they do care about is Gaza. And they blame Biden for Gaza. So you've got a whole swathe of young people coming up who directly blame Joe Biden for what's happening in Gaza and will vote for anybody else.
Or not vote.
Or
which
not
is just
vote.
As bad. Okay. Yeah. I mean, you know, I'd be amazed if many of those people voted for Trump, who after all is, you know, very pro-Israel and moved the US embassy to Jerusalem. But that's no comfort to Biden, because you're absolutely right. There's a, he's got a problem over Gaza. So you've seen that, you saw this on Super Tuesday. If you sort of dug into the weeds, a lot of people signaled their outrage over this by voting for non-committed. So in Colorado, that was 8%, or no preference. In North Carolina, was about 13%. In Minnesota, it was nearly 20%. And on the 12th of this month, there's a similar campaign in Georgia to try and get people to register their disapproval of Biden over Gaza without actually opting for a candidate. Now, the numbers involved are probably not that huge when you consider the scale of the country. But again, you have to be very, very careful, because although, yes, Biden won the popular vote in 2020 by quite a big margin, it's actually only because America votes on an electoral college system, which means each state tots up the votes and then awards a number of electors, as they're called, to the total, and you have to get 270 electors to win the presidency. Actually, tiny numbers of votes in particular parts of the of a particular state can make a huge difference. So it's the case that Biden won last time because of 40,000 voters in specific swing states. In other words, to go back to your original question, Matt, these young people who are staying away or voting for maybe a third-party candidate, probably crop up all over the place on the Gaza issue, they could deny Biden the presidency if they vote in particular swing states.
Yeah.
I mean, one must never forget that, you know, Ralph Nader didn't get many votes, probably denied Al Gore the presidency in 2000. Jill Stein, again, a Green, who didn't get that many votes, probably denied Hillary Clinton the presidency in 2016. Little things can mean a lot in this tightly geared system. So this problem Biden has with Gaza, and I don't see it going away, because he is very strongly pro-Israel. And although he's working very, very hard for a ceasefire, it's not getting anywhere. You know, as you say, this is a cohort that haven't, of voters that haven't really perceived or grown up with Trump, but they have grown up with what they see as a warlike anti-Palestinian president in the White House, who is, in their view, to use their language, causing a genocide in Gaza.
Yeah, and noticed another comment which struck a nerve with me was, you know, and it reflects on how this is all about Trump. It's not about Biden. Everything is the whole conversation is orbiting around Donald Trump. And it was, the quote was that they were talking about, this is a campaign manager for Trump, they, the Biden team, have a motivational problem and we don't. In other words, how, you know, Biden is struggling to get people to get excited about his presidency. And so he's defaulting to, never mind my presidency, think about what a disaster Trump's presidency will be. But that's such a negative position for a guy campaigning for another 4 years to run the United States of America.
No, it's a lot to say. And I was, there's interesting reports in the Washington Post this morning, we're recording on Thursday, that about how Bernie Sanders went to see Biden and said, you've got to start talking more like Franklin D. Roosevelt. You've got to start talking about the ills you're trying to cure and not just reel off a list of accomplishments. Because the problem is this, is that Biden thought two things, I think, when he stood in 2020. The first was he would be able to, if he did run in 2024, or whoever did, they would be able to run like Reagan in 1980, but on the other side. Are you better off now than you were 4 years ago? So he's produced high levels of employment, Inflation Reduction Act, has done the business, stock markets record highs, violent crimes dropped to nearly 50-year low, unemployment's below 4%, and so on and so on. I mean, the top statistics are not bad at all. The problem, of course, with inflation is that food and energy prices tend to lag behind the top line figure, and so people don't necessarily feel it. But I don't think it is just that. I think that, and we said this at the start, this was going to be an election about something deeper than economics. It was going to be about beliefs and identity and ideas, which can, of course, include economic ideas and do. But I'm not sure Biden is really digging deep enough into that. And this goes back to your point about Trump. And I think that Biden really thought that Trump would be seen off by now. And so Biden used to talk about, I'm going to be the bridge, you know, and I think that he thought by now Trump would be in the rearview mirror and he could hand over to whoever it might be, Gretchen Whitmer, the governor of Michigan, Gavin Newsom, the governor of California, his vice president, Kamala Harris, you name it. But that's not how it's worked out. And I suppose, you know, we've discussed his problems with Gaza. We've mentioned his problem with migration, which is now the number one issue, according to Gallup, which is amazing, ahead of the economy. You know, why is that? It's because of, you know, a very aggressive right-wing media that is turning this into, you know, a kind of invasion issue.
Okay, well, listen, I'll tell you what, let's just pause there for a moment for a very quick break, because when we come back, we can talk a bit more about things from Biden's point of view.
Yes, let's do that.
And I also want to talk about New York. Forget the politics. I want you to tell me how New York has been. So let's come back after a short break.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
This podcast is brought to you, as ever, by the New European newspaper. And I hope you know what the New European is by now, but you may not subscribe. And I just want to say, please do, because it's the best way to support our independent journalism. And this week, I have a superb offer for you, which is a free signed hardback copy of James O'Brien's brilliant book, How They Broke Britain. Have you read How They Broke Britain?
I have, and I think it's terrific.
Honestly, it's magnificent journalism.
Well,
isn't it?
I can't recommend it highly enough.
And it'll make you
angry
think, all of those good things. And we've got
plenty of signed copies by the man himself, James O'Brien. And you can get a free copy of James O'Brien's book when you subscribe for just a little bit more than £1 a week. And you can go to theneweuropean.co.uk/2mats to take that great offer up. Please do.
Brilliant.
And there's a link in the show notes. So welcome back, folks. Let's just talk, Matt, about Joe Biden himself and the specific problems he faces as an individual. Because let me be unkind, because he'll never listen to this, but when you see him on TV, I can't be alone in thinking, here is a man entering the latter stages of sensibility. You know, he doesn't look like he's at the races.
Yes, I mean, we've talked about the specifics of Gaza and migration, and just in parenthesis, it's worth noting that there's a big case here at the moment, tragedy actually. A young woman, 22-year-old woman called Laken Riley, who was murdered on February 22nd in a wooded area near the University of Georgia, and the man charged with her killing was an immigrant from Venezuela who, it turned out, had allegedly committed two offences in New York and Georgia. And the reason this matters, other than its intrinsic horror, is that it's beginning to be a bit of a Willie Horton. What do I mean by that? Well, Willie Horton was the individual who pretty much sank Michael Dukakis's campaign as Democratic presidential contender in '88 against George Bush Sr., because Horton had committed rape and violent crimes in Massachusetts when Dukakis was governor. And the Laken Riley case is starting to acquire that. You know, it's being horribly politicized as Biden can't handle migration. But I think, and I am getting to your point about his frailty, I don't think Biden ever really recovered from the sense that he had lost control over the retreat from Kabul in August 2021. You know, here was a guy who just wasn't in command of the situation. It wasn't so much the idea that we were retreating from Kabul, the West was retreating from Kabul. It was just that the whole thing was a total disaster. This then elides dangerously with, as you say, Matt, his you know, visibly declining health, cognitive ability, frailty. And that all came to a head when the special counsel, Robert Hur, who'd been appointed by Biden's own Attorney General, Merrick Garland, to look into his alleged unauthorized storage of classified documents. Hur found him completely exonerated, completely on the classified documents, but he made some very rude remarks about a Biden state of mind, and he used this phrase, which I think will go down in the history books, a sympathetic, well-meaning elderly man with a poor memory, and therefore crucially unfit to be prosecuted, which is a pretty damning thing to say about a serving president. And I think that really crystallized in people's minds, you know, God, you know, are we really being invited to elect this guy so he can serve as president until January 2029? It's simple, it's savage, it's horrible, but it's unfortunately, it's the kind of point that everyone can talk about.
And I don't expect that Donald Trump is going to ease off that issue.
No, not at all.
As we get closer, you know.
The problem as well, as we've discussed before, is that Trump is sort of agelessly horrible. You know, he doesn't look like a, you know, he could be 50, 150. It doesn't really matter. He looks like a sort of alien blimp, just a one man forever war. But I do think that there is a kind of problem here, which is, if you go back, Bill Clinton once said that strong and wrong generally beats weak and right. That's a very good and typically Clintonian remark. If you go back over the last, since TV really, every American president has been either strong or handsome or both. Possible exception of George W. Bush, who didn't really win anyway, as we know, because the Supreme Court handed it to him. But it's true. And this is the problem Biden has, is that back in 2020, he did still have a kind of a vigor. You know, he had that kind of Delaware, blue collar Joe vigor. You know, he was obviously getting on, but he was, go back to YouTube clips of him from then, he was a totally different kind of politician and a totally different human being, really. So this is now leading to panic everywhere. There's what's become known, amusingly, as the Ezra Klein option. Now, this is refers to Ezra Klein, who's the New York Times' star podcaster and columnist. And Ezra Klein wrote a 4,000-word or did a 4,000-word podcast in which he argued, look, Biden cannot be the candidate. He has to step down, as Lyndon Johnson did in 1968, and there has to be a contested open convention, and the Democratic Party can turn it to its advantage by making it a kind of beauty contest. And that's the best hope that the Democrats have against Trump. A lot of people are talking about this. A lot of people are, you know, find its reasoning attractive, but it won't happen. And one of the reasons is that, you know, Biden controls the Democratic Party as much as Trump controls the Republicans, and he wants to run.
Yeah, he gave an interview to the
Evan Osnos.
Yeah. And he said something quite striking and quite punchy. He said, I'm the only guy that's ever beaten Trump, and I'm going to beat him again.
And he's right. You know? There is no one who has done what he has done, which he beat him in 2020, then the midterms in 2022. Biden wasn't on the ticket, but the so-called red wave of MAGA candidates didn't happen. So Biden's point is, yeah, okay, but, you know, look at, you know, the scoreboard doesn't lie.
Yeah.
So what you've now got is, we're recording this actually on the day of the State of the Union, so we don't know what's in it, but Biden's team are saying, which is a little bit sad, but you want things to go well for the guy. They're saying, just you wait. And this is just the State of the Union speech, which is the annual presidential address to both houses of Congress about where the country is. It's an election year, so it'll be more politicized, more of a stump speech than normal. You know, the argument coming out of the White House is, this is the beginning, guys.
Yeah.
He's 81, but this is the beginning. And you're going to see a lot more of him. And he's going to be out there, and he's going to be making the case to small groups of people in interviews and so on. Possibly. I mean, to me, the big giveaway was, there are two big giveaways, actually. One was that he didn't do the Super Bowl interview, 127 million TV viewers. I mean, how crazy is it to turn down that opportunity? And the second thing, and I find this much more alarming, is that Biden's team have yet to, even now, commit to doing debates with Trump. Now, their argument is, we don't do debates with insurrectionists. But that's, he may be an insurrectionist. I think my view is he is. But the fact is, he's going to be on the ticket. He's going to be the Republican candidate, and he's ahead in the polls. So it might be an idea to get in the lists with him.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, listen, it's going to be absolutely fascinating watching this play out. The dynamics are amazing.
Well, absolutely. And one thing that we've mentioned in the pods from time to time is that one of the things that is very odd, I think, for us is that the election result may not be the end of it. 2021 proves that. January the 6th proves that. You know, Trump doesn't believe in the orderly transfer of authority. So even if he loses, that may not be the end. And I noticed you referred to the Evan Osnos interview in The New Yorker, and Biden says to him, in response to the question, you know, do you think Trump will contest the election again? And Biden's clear. He says, I just think that he'll do anything to try to win if and when I win. I think Trump will contest it, no matter what the result is. So Biden is bracing himself for January the 6th, Mark II. So, which is quite
amazing.
I thought, and you know, and more to the point, saying so in public, which may not be a bad thing, actually. It may focus people's minds.
Okay, enough politics. How is New York City?
Well, New York, I mean, one thing that's been wonderful is to be able to fill this week's Culture newsletter, which is out Friday, today. To subscribers only of the New European. And the lead item is going to be Kendall Roy, a.k.a. Jeremy Strong from Succession, starring in An Enemy of the People. And the fun is that he's opposite his brother in the play, is played by Michael Imperioli, who you may not know as a actor, but you will know as Christopher from The Sopranos, and they're terrific together.
Ah, yeah.
So there's a lot.
So it's good. Is it good?
Yeah, it's terrific. And you know, there's a fantastic exhibition of the Harlem Renaissance on at the Met, and loads and loads of great culture. I mean, New York itself is fizzing as always with, you know, all the energy and crackle that you expect of it. And it's a very strange duality, actually, because you feel that the America you love is still there and doing what it does, and in all its multiplicity and noise. But looming over your head is this terrible change in political culture. And one thing that struck me is just kind of symbolic of that is that Nikki Haley, in her sort of exit speech, quoted Margaret Thatcher. And there was a time when that would really have got American Republicans anyway going. But it struck me as very significant that today, Friday, Viktor Orban, the unlovely Prime Minister of Hungary, is visiting Trump at Mar-a-Lago. And I thought, that's the change. You know, the change is that the, you know, whether or not you like to, you know, Thatcher was a kind of figure of a certain kind of economic conservatism. Orban is a figure of very, very right-wing cultural reactionary conservatism who is now much more influential in America than Thatcher is. And that tells you where America is situated right now. And it's not a good place.
The craziest clip I saw in the last couple of weeks was Milei, the Argentinian.
Oh, yeah.
Bumping into, meeting Trump. I don't know whether it was Mar-a-Lago or somewhere else.
No, it was at the Conservative Political Action.
Okay, it was, yeah.
Where our very own Liz Truss was in action.
But Milei comes in like some sort of Ali G impression of a Latin American dictator, you know. Mr. Presidente!
I mean, he had stars in his eyes, yeah, didn't he? That was what's so depressing.
It was incredible.
It is a globe. I mean, this is where, and I think, you know, there's lots for us to discuss in the weeks and months ahead, which is that it really is a global movement now. And the idea that it was all going to fade away, and, you know, it's 9 years now since Trump came down that bloody golden escalator. And the thing is carrying on. The thing is not going away, not with Trump, but also not more broadly around the place. North Carolina just chose as its candidate for Republican governor a Holocaust denier. I mean, that just gives you an idea of where we are.
I should mention, by the way, since we were talking about your cultural newsletter in the New European and Succession actors and actresses, I went to see Sarah Snook on your recommendation playing Dorian Gray. One of the most astonishing pieces of theatre I've ever seen. Absolutely extraordinary.
Isn't it?
She is amazing. The production is amazing. And Oscar Wilde is bloody amazing as well. I mean, what a great story.
He's all right, isn't he?
Yeah, not bad. He's got a good future, that boy.
He's got a good future.
Okay.
He's a Remainer.
Yeah. So thank you very much indeed, listeners. I hope you've enjoyed this very first transatlantic edition of the Two Mats. Get in your questions as ever and any feedback you've got to twomats@tnepublishing.com. That's the number 2MATTS at tnepublishing.com. Or if you listen on Spotify, you can message us there very simply. We are back with a new Q&A episode on Sunday. Please remember our subscription offer. If you like the journalism you're listening to on the podcast, I guarantee you will love the journalism in the New European. Just go to theneweuropean.co.uk/2Mats. And there's a link in the show notes. Thanks as ever to producer Matt Hill at Rethink Audio with support from Ollie Peart. And until next week.
It's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from him.
Goodbye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.